My name is Joost Blom, and I'm standing in tonight for Mr. David Lemon, the president of the Vancouver Institute. And before I introduce our lecturer this evening, it's my duty to remind you of the many benefits of belonging to the Vancouver Institute. Among those are preferred seating before 8 o'clock and a tax credit that you get for your donation, not only for your membership fee, but also for any additional donation that you are able to make. And let me just remind you again of the quite amazingly inexpensive price of membership. Family memberships are $25, singles are $15, and students are $5. And let me encourage you, if you haven't already done so, to become members of the Vancouver Institute. Now, tonight's lecture is the J.V. Klein Lecture. This is named in honor, as many of you will know, of the Honorable John Valentine Klein, who had a multifaceted career. He was an actor at one stage of his life. He was a lawyer, he was a judge, he was a prominent businessman, president of Macmillan Burdell, and just as importantly as all those, he was a dedicated friend of the University of British Columbia and served on Senate and the Board of Governors, and also two terms as chancellor of the university. And because of the many sides to Mr. Klein's career, the Klein Lectureship was established and is shared between the faculties of Arts, Commerce, and Law. Our speaker this evening has a background in law, but it's also an exceptionally multifaceted background. Professor Harry Arthurs is one of Canada's most distinguished jurists, university administrators, and scholars. He took his BA and LLB from the University of Toronto and his LLM from Harvard. He was called to the Bar of Ontario in 1961 and began teaching in that year at Osgoode Hall Law School, which at that time was still downtown Toronto in the Osgoode Hall, but in 1968 became part of York University. He served as Dean of Osgoode Hall Law School from 1972 to 77, and subsequently as President of York University from 1985 to 1992. And he is now University Professor at York University and at Osgoode Hall Law School, and since 1995 as well, an Associate of the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research. He has been honored at different times in his career with visiting appointments at the universities of Toronto, McGill, Cambridge, Oxford, and London. He was president of the Canadian Civil Liberties Association in 1976-77. And among his other honors, he is a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada, an officer of the Order of Canada, and he is a member of the Order of Ontario. Now, in his scholarly work, he is anything but a narrow specialist. His work has ranged over labor law, in which he was one of the pioneers, really, of the field, administrative law, civil liberties, legal history, and legal education. And I can tell you that in the last of those fields, legal education, he has been one of the most consistently challenging and creative thinkers about the role of law schools in the university system and in the legal profession. And moreover, unlike many thinkers about legal education, he has practiced as well as preached, in the sense that he has taken on the administrative tasks that I have mentioned. I'm delighted that he is able to join us this evening as the J.V. Klein Lecturer, 1997, and he will speak to us tonight on globalization and its discontents. Professor Harry Arthurs.
Well, this evening is an almost surreal experience for me, I have to tell you. I have flown these 2,500 miles with a load of discontents too large to carry on board as hand luggage. You have given up the pleasures of Saturday night in one of the world's great cities. And here we all are gathered to talk about globalization. That's strange enough. But I'm absolutely intrigued that the Vancouver Institute, plugged so effectively by my friend Jost, has managed to sustain this cult of civic masochism for as many years as it has done. And frankly, I'm totally bemused to be delivering a lecture named in honor of J.V. Klein, one of British Columbia's most distinguished citizens and an outstanding judge, but one, I have to confess, whose labor law decisions failed to charm me as a young law professor. Still, we're all here despite these anomalies, and I think we better make the most of the opportunity. So let me start with a definition of globalization. Political economists would like to tell us that globalization describes a world economic order in which capital and trade and production and information flow to their logical destinations without being artificially constrained by national boundaries and national policies. If a particular country or community enjoys a comparative advantage in, say, raw materials or cheap labor, it will attract a certain combination of the factors of production. Likewise with capital. Investors will appraise exchange rates and the risk of investing in this country or that, and off they go. Far from being constrained by national boundaries, they are positively wooed by governments, anxious for new projects and more jobs. And likewise with the other factors of production, intellectual property, management skills, political connections, brand names, and physical security. All of these become globalized. All find their way to markets where willing sellers await willing buyers. And we all live happily and profitably ever after, buying Levi's in far-off places, watching CNN around the world, using bank cards to access exotic currencies. There is something, let's say, postmodern in this account of globalization, which is reason enough to trigger my discontent, if not yours. But in fact, globalization has had a long and checkered career. The Hudson's Bay Company, the East India Company, and their rivals from Holland and France and the other European powers began the process 400 years ago with one powerful insight. There is a lot of money to be made by exporting capital and goods and know-how to distant parts of the world where they can be exchanged for commodities and services in short supply at home. In certain respects, the great mercantile companies of the 17th and 18th centuries closely resembled the transnational corporations of our own time. They were able to escape from the feeble constraints of national sovereignty into the virtually unregulated spaces of transnational commerce. They were largely indifferent to public morality, and in turn were sometimes ruined by corruption, treachery, and greed. They came seeking profit, but they often left trailing conflicts of religion and culture. Like today's globalization, the expansion of world trade 300 or 400 years ago ushered in a period of great institutional and legal creativity. Much of the machinery of transnational trade was invented during this period. The joint stock company, marine insurance, international arbitration, bills of lading, the stock market, international currency exchanges. And finally, like the globalization of the late 20th century, this early wave of globalization left in its wake winners and losers. It transformed social relations as well as patterns of production and consumption. It disturbed ecosystems and distributed deadly diseases. And it expanded the cultural horizons and political aspirations of people everywhere. But at the core of it all, at the core, globalization then, as now, was about wealth and dreams of wealth. So globalization has had a long and checkered history. And truth to tell, it also has a checkered present and future. That present and future is largely driven by technology. By substituting machine labor and digital intelligence for animal labor and human intelligence, technology has utterly changed the way we produce things. This, in turn, makes possible mass production, which in turn leads to mass consumption, which in turn leads to continuous expansion of the markets needed to consume ever-increasing outputs, which in turn, of course, leads to globalization. And technology has changed not only the scale, but also the site, the location of production. Depending on which is most efficient, we can consolidate production functions under a single roof. We can distribute them across a local network of just-in-time suppliers or disperse them globally. And finally, I have to mention that technology has shaped that distinctive, that dominant institution of the current era, the transnational corporation, with its extended family of subsidiaries and networks and alliances and suppliers and customers. I'll have a lot to say about these corporations later in my lecture. For now, I want to return to the political economist's account of globalization. The smoothly organized world economy of comparative advantage, of division of labor, of efficiency, of profitability. This is, to say the least, a sanitized version of globalization. It leaves out a lot. For example, while money, goods, and services move ever more freely, ordinary people do not. True, there has been some globalization of human misery. If Vietnamese boat people or Somali intellectuals wash up on our shores, we give them refuge. If villages are destroyed in Bosnia or dissidents are executed in Nigeria, we can watch more or less in real time. But almost everywhere, in the peaceful, in the wealthy part of the world, Canada being at best a marginal exception, barriers to immigration are rising, foreign aid budgets are falling, and a sense of global responsibility for local atrocities and barbarism is receding. Globalization is about money, not about sentiment. Nor is globalization really about culture. True, new export markets have opened up for the American entertainment industry. But there are no offsetting flows into America of, say, Beijing opera or South Indian dance or even French movies or Italian pop music. No, I have to say that's not exactly true. For anyone who is particularly interested because of family heritage or academic specialism or exotic taste, there is, in fact, probably better access to more cultures than ever before. But essentially, culture has become a valuable commodity whose distribution is shaped by the inexorable logic of the global marketplace, efficient sources of production and channels of distribution, high technology, large capital investments, and the comparative advantage of the English language, all of which have led to increased market share for a very narrow range of cultural products. Nor, alas, has globalization contributed much to the universal practice of democracy and human rights, although once again the record is somewhat mixed. Some countries, have carved out their niche in the global economy by suppressing trade unions and political opposition. They call it enforcing social discipline, exploiting women and children, euphemistically referred to as an expression of traditional culture, degrading Aboriginal populations, otherwise known as modernization, and running great engines of official corruption, protection of national interests against foreign exploitation. Nor are these strategies in more polite forms, I have to say, unknown in the industrial democracies themselves. To be fair, such abuses did not begin with globalization, though they've often become more extreme in its wake. And in some countries, globalization may actually have helped to limit abuses. After all, most of the world is now within reach of television crews, the internet, and fax machines. Abuse is more difficult to conceal and easier to publicize. And publicity has made abusive governments more susceptible to pressures from their trading partners and to consumer boycotts orchestrated by social movements abroad. Indeed, to the extent that globalization has contributed to greater affluence and greater education, it may even have strengthened internal as well as foreign-based resistance. But while giving globalization its due, as the Chinese and Indonesian cases make clear, free markets and free trade do not automatically translate into free societies. Nor has globalization been very kind to the environment, which is global if anything is. The industrialized world has so far been the greatest culprit. Having depleted its own resources, it's helped itself to everyone else's. Having polluted its own environment, it's encouraged similar behavior elsewhere. But the rest of the world is doing quite well on its own, thank you. Korea and Brazil, for example, seem determined to show that they are at least as capable of environmental degradation as the most advanced countries. All of that is very much a negative aspect of globalization. On the other hand, as I've suggested with regard to democratic rights, globalization has also given us new ways of bringing these ills to the attention of the world and consequently new strategies for resisting, if not reversing them. To sum up this part of my analysis and to identify the first of those documents, of those discontents that I brought with me. Globalization has been too preoccupied with economics, too remote from human concerns. The free movement of people, the preservation and dissemination of most cultures, respect for democratic values, and protection of the environment have by no means been globalized. On the contrary, despite some new channels of publicity and of protest, globalization has often made things worse rather than better. Now I want to take you on the second leg of discontent, the global tour. I've just tried to show how globalization has produced negative rather than positive outcomes in various realms of social and economic life. Now I want to suggest that different countries experience globalization in different ways. It's not the same for the great economic powers such as the United States as it is for the Asian tigers, now a somewhat tamer species, or for similar semi-peripheral countries such as Canada. Nor indeed is globalization the same for all regions within a given country. New York, the global headquarters of the corporate headquarters of the global economy, has had a different experience from, say, Buffalo. Toronto, the Canadian epicenter of finance and manufacturing, has not experienced globalization in the same way as Vancouver, the Pacific gateway for outward-bound natural products and inward-bound members of the Chinese diaspora. And to extend my point to its logical conclusion, globalization has had different effects for different people in any given community. For unemployed workers, corporate directors, small business people, software designers, and people in the arts. Hence the next of the discontents I intend to inflict upon you this evening. Globalization has helped to redefine our place in the world as countries, as communities, and as citizens. As we take stock of our new location, some of us will see the changes as exhilarating and highly profitable, others as traumatic and deeply destructive. You will have trouble convincing a terminally unemployed steelworker in Sydney, Nova Scotia, for example, that he should reconcile himself to the irrefutable logic of the International Division of Labor. Explain to a 25-year-old currency trader in London that she has earned her six-figure bonus by destroying families in Kuala Lumpur or Coquitlam, and she will chuckle all the way to the bank. Globalization is clearly too complex, too diffuse, too divisive to be understood as a single narrative. But that's the way we're invited to read it in the official version. Not merely as profitable for some people in some places under given circumstances, but as universally beneficial, as totally rational, even as inevitable. What discontents me about this official version is that it's the winner's version, not the loser's version, not even the bystander's version. It's not only incomplete, but misleading, and not only misleading, but callous. It's written too many people out of history, out of prosperity, out of democracy. And that's the nature of my second profound discontent about globalization. Which brings me directly to my third. I'm very much concerned that my country and my community and my children may be marginalized by globalization. Frankly, I find myself a little startled to be saying those words. I'm not here to wave the flag. I have no intention of relitigating the fight over NAFTA. I'm certainly not about to lead a children's crusade against global capitalism. I have a very much more modest project in mind. I want to explore more closely how Canada's particular location within the global economic system may operate to our disadvantage in quite a serious way. Call this a contingent discontent. If I'm wrong, as I hope I am, I promise to strike it from my list. Let me begin by reiterating that I'm going to talk not about national politics, but about corporate politics. And I'm going to talk not about the poor and downtrodden, but about some of the most privileged people in our society. My concern is that current developments in the structure and governance of transnational corporations may adversely affect Canadians who work in them and with them. I've already said that these corporations are the most visible and active agents of globalization. They drive it, they profit from it, they epitomize it. And they largely determine how Canada experiences it. Subsidiaries of transnationals account for something like 20% of the total book value of Canadian business, apart from financial institutions. 30% of our industrial production, 50% of our largest corporations, and 60 to 70% of our exports, about half of which, by the way, are intra-firm transfers. These transnationals already dominate many sectors of the Canadian economy: petrochemicals, pharmaceuticals, publishing, the automobile manufacturing industry. As globalization proceeds apace, they are likely to dominate many more, including banking and telecommunications and retailing and transportation. As I indicated, This is not a rant about foreign ownership, nor the prelude to a romantic tale about how Canadian companies are better corporate citizens than their foreign-based counterparts. Rather, these familiar statistics are intended only to make the case that what goes on within these transnational corporations is of enormous importance to Canadians. Here's what seems to be happening. Globalized production exploits the well-known advantages of economies of scale and the division of labor. Instead of having plants in a dozen countries, each churning out a wide range of products in small quantities to serve local needs, a smaller number of plants can be assigned specialized mandates to turn out one particular product or parts of a product in much larger numbers and at lower unit costs to serve the entire regional or world market. This affects how transnationals organize themselves. Research and development and product design were always centralized at the headquarters of the transnational. However, thanks to information technology, head office can now also directly oversee many additional corporate functions which used to be done by local subsidiaries. Finance, inventory, customer services can be operated by remote control. Advertising campaigns can be developed at a central location and beamed across borders. Capital can be raised by offering shares in London, New York, or Tokyo, which are accessible to investors around the world and around the clock without the cost and bother of listing on local exchanges in other countries. Thus, the logic of globalization is leading to a concentration of certain key functions at or near corporate headquarters. This produces greater coherence and efficiency in decision-making. As a necessary corollary, the subsidiaries of these transnationals perform fewer of these functions, and those they still perform, they perform with less autonomy. In fact, it's no longer necessary for subsidiaries in many countries to speak in the local vernacular on behalf of the parent firm as it tries to penetrate local markets, deal with local laws and policies, and transact business with local suppliers and unions. Now, with free trade, with deregulated labor markets, with growing competition for global investment, formal entry barriers and idiosyncratic performance requirements have largely disappeared. International marketing and brand name strategies have helped to facilitate local acceptance of standard goods from around the world. Even local laws present much less of a problem. A transnational legal system is starting to emerge in key areas such as intellectual property and insolvency and contract law. For all of these reasons, many transnationals feel they no longer need a full-blown local management structure with a prestigious local board of directors, a resident high-octane CEO, and a full range of locally recruited specialists. While these forces are at play everywhere, Canada is a special case. Foreign transnationals, as I've tried to explain, are particularly prominent in our economy. They're mostly American-based, and they operate under the umbrella of NAFTA. Back at head office, it must seem extremely sensible to bring Canadian subsidiaries under direct supervision and detailed control. We're right next door. We mostly speak the same language, read the same magazine, watch the same soaps. Business, finance, and industrial relations practices in the two countries are rather similar. Most of our political and legal institutions look pretty familiar to Americans, and of course, it's relatively simple to move information and know-how and components and finished products and experts and money and merchandising strategies and advertising copy back and forth across the border. Why, people at head office ask, should Canadian operations report through autonomous corporate structures when those in California or Kentucky do not. As a result, changes in the governance structures of multinationals are being felt especially in Canada. Most of the large Canadian subsidiaries, which until recently were widely held public companies, have been taken private. In many of them, extensive restructuring and rationalization has produced a more focused, a leaner Canadian operation, and significant head office functions, which used to be performed in Toronto or Montreal, now reside in Chicago or, much more likely, in New York. This last point is more important than it might seem at first blush. Economic geographers have called attention to the importance of high-end, high-value-added producer services essential to corporate decision-making. These include software and product designers, accountants, management consultants, lawyers, market researchers, and advertising agencies. Such services, like the corporate headquarters they serve, tend to cluster in a very limited list of so-called global cities. This concentration of producer services, in turn, shapes the local labor market by creating a demand for real estate, for luxury restaurants, for clothing stores, and so on, all the way down the food chain to security guards and nannies. Wonderful, wonderful if you happen to be a city with a lot of head offices. Not so wonderful if head office functions and producer services are actually starting to move out of your city and back to home base in the United States. Not wonderful at all. Some of our largest and wealthiest cities, mine for example and yours, will be hit very hard indeed. In fact, the signs are beginning to appear already. Canada's major accounting, consulting, and advertising firms have mostly become branch plants. The legal profession may not be far behind if the experience of European law firms is any precedent. Likewise, many Canadian software and design companies are being absorbed into larger US-based enterprises, which have closer connections with their most important clientele, the headquarters of transnational companies. Nor does the story end there. Corporations tend, like all of us, to give it home, to display their philanthropy somewhere near head office. If there's no Canadian head office, or only the pale shade of a head office past, Canada can expect less corporate generosity, just at a time when we seem to need it most. Similarly, senior executives often provide civic leadership and lend corporate support to efforts to improve local government and infrastructure. With fewer senior executives living here, we can predict that civic enterprises will have a harder time of it. That certainly is the experience in American cities, which, for similar reasons, no longer house regional headquarters. But most of all, the key point, if Canadian subsidiaries have less autonomy, if their leadership has been depleted or disbanded, how will they make their weight felt in the corporate politics of the transnational corporation itself? When decisions are being taken to open or close a plant, to invest or disinvest, to assign or withdraw a product mandate, who will make the case on behalf of the Canadian operation? Not the directors of the Canadian subsidiary, they are no more. Not the nominal Canadian CEO, who now reports to some lowly division manager who doesn't even have a seat on the board of directors. Not the Canadian executives, now connected umbilically to head office by email. The phenomenon I'm describing isn't unique, of course, to transnational companies. It's what frustrates people in, say, Winnipeg or Hamilton when they're unable to influence head office decisions in Calgary or Toronto. But in the case of foreign transnationals, especially American transnationals, the stakes are higher, and the risks of being marginalized within the corporate decision-making process are greater. I don't want to overstate my case, though you may think it's a bit late for such a disclaimer. My argument has been that transnational corporations themselves, so crucial to globalization, so dominant in the Canadian economy, are undergoing changes in their governance and structure, which may damage some of the most advanced and strategic elements of the Canadian economy. True, if Canada's workers and natural resources continue to be regarded as valuable assets by transnational corporations, other elements of our economy may perhaps flourish. But if we all hew auto parts and draw oil, this will hardly assure Canada a leading role in the global economy. So here we have my third discontent. Canada will not be able to keep hold of the high-end, high-value-added producer services which cluster in and around head offices and which are so crucial to success in the new global economy. And now my fourth. Globalization isn't only a new reality. It's a new paradigm, a new way of understanding reality. This has a serious and disempowering consequence. We can't imagine how things might be otherwise, how we might create a more humane form of globalization, or at least one which isn't quite so harmful to so many people. There's a sense that globalization and all its works are almost a force of nature, incapable of being changed by the puny efforts of mere men and women. We didn't always have such a passive view of the world economic order. For the first 30 or so years after the war, most governments in most industrialized democracies, most of the time, seem to share the basic social democratic belief that the state can and should try to make things better, especially for those most in need. With varying degrees of enthusiasm and conviction and follow-through, most governments were committed to promoting full employment, evening out the business cycle, mitigating the worst inequalities of income and opportunity, and quite specifically, managing relationships with the rest of the world's economy. This translated into a series of programs which, now it's quite hard to remember, sought to shield individual citizens from the worst consequences of capitalism, from diseases, old age, childhood, and other natural disasters. The state actively intervened to prevent the abuse of power in the marketplace and the workplace, to guarantee universal access to education, housing, and health care, to support science and the arts, and to redistribute wealth at the margins through progressive taxation and social benefits. All of this happened, it appears at least in retrospect, with a remarkable degree of consensus across national boundaries and party lines. But somehow, the post-war social democratic consensus has disappeared, or possibly it has been disappeared. People have become convinced that taxes are too high, that governments are incompetent and profligate. They want government out of their pockets, out of their faces, out of the marketplace, even out of politics. And if the state is conceded some residual role as a night watchman, as the last resort supplier of common goods, then someone is sure to argue that whichever government has the money hasn't got the constitutional power, or vice versa. Not surprisingly, in this climate, most governments are no longer willing and no longer able to sustain former levels of state expenditure and benign state activism. How did this happen? I'm going to suggest that in part the state has stumbled under the weight of its own ambition. Many social democratic interventions, however well meant, did not produce the hoped-for results. Welfare, public housing, town planning are three cases in point. In part two, confidence in state action was systematically undermined by a coalition of populists and neoconservatives, the one with a touching faith that for every complex problem there is a simple solution, the other with an equally touching faith that that simple solution is the market. Honorable mention goes as well to powerful corporations, which have no touching faith at all, but would prefer not to be disturbed in their pursuit of profit and power. But it was globalization, which finally put paid to the activist state. Or more accurately, globalization finished off the social democratic version of the activist state. The new version of the state, the globalized version, is activist as well, but in quite a different way. Indeed, it could hardly be otherwise. After the war, states established the Bretton Woods mechanism for regulating international flows of capital to enable them to maintain some control over exchange rates and therefore over domestic fiscal and monetary policies. It was a pretty good system for its time. Some say it was the basis of the post-war recovery, which lasted until the 1970s. But then states decided to demolish Bretton Woods and to create a new international regime, a new system of unregulated global financial markets. This is a critical point. In the new system, states simply can't pursue the Keynesian financial strategies which supported the old social democratic initiatives. Instead, they have given currency speculators and bond traders the right to pass judgment on, the right to veto their tax policies and their interest rates, and thus, in essence, all future government initiatives. Likewise, states decided to negotiate free trade treaties, abolish tariffs, adhere to international conventions on double taxation or copyright, and regulate foreign investors as feebly as they regulate their own. All of these further narrowed the range of domestic policy options. But remember, this is something states did to themselves through the exercise of their sovereign powers, which sounds a lot like state activism to me. Anyone who thinks otherwise ought to be forced to sit down and read the hundreds of statutes which had to be amended in order to implement the NAFTA. Good punishment, that. Nor are these the only ways in which the state has become active, now that it's giving up on market regulation and social welfare. Much of the current political agenda, in fact, involves aggressive use of the state's coercive powers, more police and prisons, welfare reform by forcing people into marginal jobs or workfare, more effective controls on illegal immigration, and the radical restructuring of local governments, healthcare, education, and labor market institutions by fiat, stealth, and misrepresentation. I think it's fair to say that government not only continues to be activist, it's positively belligerent. Globalization is clearly not the only reason for this awesome mobilization of state power. However, globalization has created powerful incentives for states to deflect the insecurity and anger caused by the end of the welfare state, to restore labor market discipline, to lower taxation levels, and by doing all of these things, to create attractive conditions for investment. To this extent, globalization is not merely a byproduct of the new state agenda, but a cause. Overall, then, in the past 20 years or so, as globalization has proceeded apace, the state has abandoned benign activism in favor of coercive activism. Social democratic intervention in favor of neoconservative intervention. You may by now possibly have guessed that I intend to add this to my list of discontents. This would be an astute guess, but I have to tell you, not a wholly accurate one. What troubles me most about all this is not the demise of the welfare state, for which I have to confess nostalgic hankerings, nor even the rise of neoconservatism, which rather puzzles me. But political pendulums swing and consensuses dissolve and new ideas come to the fore and old ones fade away. All of that I readily accept as part of the democratic process. That's not what's going to go on my list. No, the discontent I want to add to my list is of quite a different order. What troubles me most is the idea that globalization may be able to make the pendulum stop swinging, to end political debate, to prevent new consensuses from emerging in the future. If globalization does that, our democratic rights will have been diminished and we'll all be very discontented indeed, regardless of our current political preference. Well, how might globalization accomplish this? How might it interfere with democracy? Broadly speaking, there are two answers, the one intellectual, the other institutional. The intellectual answer first, though I concede it's the more contentious. We're experiencing something I'll call globalization of the mind, the paradigm of which I spoke earlier. All over the world, knowledge-based elites, politicians, civil servants, academics, business executives, journalists, have come to believe that open economies and minimal governments are the only option. Attribute this consensus to the financial and moral failure of social democracy, suspend this belief and acknowledge that neoconservatism makes a powerful intellectual case. But let's be realistic. Proponents of the open economy, of neoconservative policies, platforms in legislation, in editorial effusions, and they pretty much got the rest of us used to the idea that any departure from the global consensus is not only unwise, but ultimately impossible. Nobel Prizes in economics are awarded so predictably to Chicago School economists that one is almost convinced that they confer the same blessings on humanity as the laureates who end wars, write sublime works of literature, or plumb the secrets of the physical universe. We've reached the end of history, says Francis Fukuyama, awarding game, set, match, and permanent possession of the trophy to neoconservatism. There is no alternative, said Mrs. Thatcher again and again, which proved to be a self-fulfilling prophecy until the British voters, and particularly her own party, decided otherwise. Still, globalization of the mind does have its limits. Though apparently consensed, minds are notoriously reluctant to stay that way. Oppositional social movements had become organized on a global scale as well. Ideas such as human rights and environmental responsibility are now advocated around the world, even if they aren't yet practiced everywhere. And even some prominent standard bearers for globalization at the World Bank, at the OECD, at the World Economic Forum in Davos have recently expressed alarm about its failure to improve the lives of so many people in so many countries, from those with the most affluent and open economies to those with the least. Precisely because neoconservatism is unlikely to be sustained by faith alone, true believers have tried to institutionalize it, to make it part of the fundamental constitution, both of states and of the world economic system. An initial step in this process, as I mentioned a few moments ago, was the dismantling of the Bretton Woods system. Next came the conversion of the World Bank and the IMF, originally creatures of that same Bretton Woods system, into enforcing agents for the doctrines of globalization. To maintain access to these important facilities, countries had to agree to suppress government spending, adopt free market policies, and subscribe to free trade principles. Those principles, of course, are also enshrined in the GATT and in its successor, the World Trade Organization, which seeks to make free trade in goods and services an irreversible feature of the global economy. Now, complementary steps are being taken in the proposed multilateral agreement on investment to ensure that capital can flow forever across state boundaries without obstruction by anything so parochial as national policies protecting domestic financial institutions or cultural domains. Similar constitutional arrangements are being put in place at the regional level. The EU, European Union, is entrenching economic orthodoxy by bringing its members into a common currency protected by a common fiscal and monetary regime. The NAFTA, while less overt or elegant in its institutional arrangements, has in effect achieved hub-and-spoke integration of the three partner economies, with the United States permanently enshrined as the hub. I've called these arrangements constitutional in character. By that I mean to convey that the global trumps the local. When countries adhere to international treaties, when they take out membership in international organizations, when they sign on for arrangements which promote free trade and facilitate globalization, they are committing themselves to alter their domestic policies to conform with the assumptions of the new world economic order. In the long run, it might be argued, Canada will be the winner. Well, maybe so, maybe not. But my point is that such decisions are no longer made one by one through our own democratic political processes. They are forced on us holus bolus as a condition of membership in the globalized economy. It's true that globalization is not entirely to blame for these attempts to constitutionalize the neoconservative version of political economy. There are domestic forces working to the same end. Nonetheless, globalization adds another level of complexity, of obscurity, of subtlety. In fact, it's their subtlety, their invisibility, their complexity, which makes global constraints so effective. It's not just that NAFTA initially required that we amend hundreds of federal statutes. It's that every other statute which affects the economy, every significant government policy, is potentially the subject of a complaint by our trading partners in NAFTA, the WTO, the Multilateral Agreement on Investment. Yes, it's true. These complaints can be sent off to trade tribunals, but their procedures are slow, they operate in a highly politicized context, and they lack effective remedial powers. Even if we were to win most of our cases, even if we were to win all of our cases, over the years we're likely to become litigation averse, to refrain from even contemplating policies which might trigger further complaints. In fact, we may not be very far from that point even now. Of course, these aren't constitutional constraints in the formal sense. National sovereignty remains unimpaired. Governments retain the right to terminate their treaty obligations by appropriate notice. In principle, they're perfectly free to resign from the world trading system and regain control of their own economies. However, the reality is otherwise. The consequences of resigning, of going it alone, especially for a country like Canada, are likely to be extremely traumatic. It's in this sense that globalization has constitutional force. It constrains the way in which state power is exercised just as effectively as any constitution, and maybe more so. Here we arrive at the crux of my fourth discontent. The governance of the global economy is not democratic. In the global economy, there are only markets, no elections, no voice of the people, no institutions of accountability, hardly any politics at all. As a result, important social and economic decisions affecting our lives, which used to be taken democratically within states, are now being taken globally, effectively beyond the reach of any particular state and of any democratic process whatsoever. This is a pretty profound discontent if you happen to value democracy. Now, I have to be fair. In most democracies, markets often do trump politics. Principles are sometimes sacrificed, and some groups are favored over others. Perhaps it's a bit unrealistic, or at least a bit premature, to expect more from the global economy. Perhaps given time, given more experience with globalization, democratic institutions will emerge at the global level. These are pretty large perhapses. Let's examine them in the context of the European Union, the most ambitious experiment to date in creating a transnational economic space with a social dimension and with democratic institutions. The European Union, of course, has its own directly elected parliament. However, that parliament has not yet acquired ultimate control over economic, social, and cultural policies, which still remain subordinate to the member states and to the EU's own extensive bureaucracy and judiciary. Nor, to be blunt, does NAFTA hold out much promise as a model of supranational democracy. It's pretty overtly an agreement of sovereign states to work towards regional economic integration without cultural, social, or political integration. NAFTA aspires to nothing even so modest as the European Parliament. Its few transnational institutions of accountability, such as those established under the Labour Side Accord, seek only to hold each country to compliance with its own laws. So if we can't seriously manage accountability regimes, even in North America, if enlightened and sophisticated Europe can't create transnational democracy, what hope is there for the global economy? Well, I've just about run out of discontents, not to say time. I want to conclude by applying a famous epigram of Gramsci, an Italian philosopher and critic of Mussolini, who, had he not died in Mussolini's jails, would, I suspect, have been no fan of globalization. Gramsci said he believed in pessimism of the mind, but optimism of the will. I think I've dispensed enough pessimism for one Saturday night. Now I just need a few moments to administer a modest dose of optimism. Optimism, oddly, hasn't got much to do with idealism. Rather, at least in my version, it stems from some practical problems of globalization, which are leading even its proprietors, even its proponents, to see the benefits of accountable and, ultimately, democratic institutions. There's a growing concern that a totally deregulated global economy is too much of a good thing. Great banking houses are destroyed by rogue bond traders. Commodity exchanges are destabilized by brazen crooks. Whole economies disappear into Swiss bank accounts. And all the stock markets of Europe and America are turned chaotic by the butterfly wings of currency speculators half a world away. None of this is good for business. Structures are needed to prevent fraud and corruption, and to ensure sensible trading practices. They are needed to suppress some of the most profitable aspects of the global economy, the trade in narcotics, terror, money, dirty money, and sex. They are needed to respond to increasing consumer resistance to products made by sweated labor or wrenched from fragile ecosystems. Well, what will those structures look like? Perhaps they'll resemble existing transnational institutions, which already provide facilities for bank clearances, coordinate technical product standards, lay down rules for shipping and air transport. Or perhaps non-governmental regimes will promulgate and enforce codes of conduct. Or perhaps we'll end up with something more closely resembling public legislation, with agencies such as the World Trade Organization promulgating and enforcing internationally agreed social clauses and environmental standards. None of these arrangements is comprehensive. Some are of dubious efficacy, and for sure, all are a long way from perfect accountability and true democracy. But the slow accretion of regulatory regimes may ultimately produce more comprehensive and representative institutions. After all, the social democratic state itself emerged only gradually from 200 years of fitful experimentation. Perhaps we may find ourselves someday with global accountability and global politics, even global governance, as well as sound global markets and increasing global prosperity. Personally, I would welcome that day. Of course, hard choices would have to be made, but things would no longer seem quite so inevitable. At least we'd be spared fatuous odes to the power of greed, not to say long, boring lectures on our discontents. Instead, I hope, we'd have serious debates and democratic decisions and a new globalization, which is more inclusive, more humane, and more responsible. Thank you so much. How does global warming fit into the discussion that we're having this evening? Obviously, a very contentious subject. I don't pretend to be an expert on global warming. Indeed, in a candid moment, I'm not an expert on anything that I've talked about, but certainly not on global warming. I did try to say that if the most likely hypothesis is true, if the way we have been using our resources to pump stuff into the atmosphere is indeed the cause of global warming, it's still a hypothesis, but that seems to be the most likely one, then what can we anticipate? We can anticipate that on the one side, globalization with increased consumption and increased production to meet that consumption, with more and more people at best, if globalization is right, enjoying consumer goods, starting to drive cars, starting to work in factories, and so forth. If all of those things are going to happen, which is globalization's positive promise to people outside the existing industrialized countries, then for sure we're going to have more problems with global warming. I think that's almost certain to be the case. Secondly, if we lack institutions of global governance, if we lack ways of bringing ourselves under control, not to say other people, by ourselves, I mean the community of advanced industrial states, then it seems to me that the strategies which so far haven't worked, which are now being reviewed, as you know, in the forthcoming, in the upcoming conference in Kyoto, if we lack institutions which extend across national boundaries, if we're wholly dependent on the willingness of states to restrain themselves, then it seems to me we've really got a serious problem. And then we've got a final problem. Even if we're prepared to restrain ourselves at this stage in the advancement of our economic interests, when we've already accomplished so much, we will be perceived to be attempting to deprive newly developing economies of their opportunities by holding them to standards which we didn't impose on ourselves at early stages of our own industrial development. So I have to say that global warming and other phenomena related to the abuse of the environment is very much on the agenda as far as I'm concerned.
Paint a picture of the universal acceptance of globalization, and everybody seems to think that it's all so wonderful and has no downside, and that sovereignty is ending, and that the welfare state is finished. How do you reconcile that particular picture with the fact, for example, that Clinton cannot get fast-track authority, which indicates that most of Congress is not keen on globalization, sees a lot of downsides, that half our income goes to taxes, so that the government really is such a huge part of our economy, and always will be. And I just think of that as far as independence in what we're doing, I mean, it's remarkable to me that Canada has lower interest rates than in the United States, which, I mean, I always grew up and we would always have higher interest rates in the United States.
Well, those are each quite separate questions and perfectly fair questions. Let me try to respond to them. The first question was, how do we explain, if my hypothesis is right, the reluctance of the American Congress to give President Clinton fast-track authority, which would facilitate the making of these global arrangements? Doesn't that indicate resistance in the United States itself to globalization? I'd like to answer that at two levels. At one level, I think reluctance to give the President fast-track authority means that they are reluctant to give the President fast-track authority. It isn't globalization they're opposed to. It's removing from congressmen the power to use the approval process when treaties are tendered to tack onto it all kinds of advantages which will assist their own re-election. The whole point of the treaty approval process, going through Senate other than on a fast-track basis, he's still free to take his treaties there, is the historic record of people saying, if you don't give me this naval base or that research lab or whatever, we're not going to approve. I'm not going to vote for your treaty. So I think a large part of, by no means all, but certainly a large part of the congressional reluctance is very much a reflection of that tradition in treaty approvals. It's quite different, as you know, from our own system of approving treaties. That's at one level. To me, more persuasive, an argument in favor of your version of events, or at least the one you're trying on for my delectation, is the campaign of Pat Buchanan in the last presidential primaries, who had a virulently anti-free trade campaign. And at one moment, it really seemed to catch fire when he was speaking, to steel workers in Alabama who were desperately afraid that they would end up like steel workers in Sydney, Nova Scotia. And it did seem to touch a raw nerve, and it's a raw nerve which the resurgent American trade union movement, or at least it's if not resurgent, it's at least a little less comatose than it has been recently, the trade union movement obviously is very concerned about the jobs of industrial workers. They were very concerned about NAFTA. They're very concerned about similar deals which may lead to the export of industrial production jobs abroad. And they certainly were lobbying hard in the context of the fast-track negotiations. But they don't have a lot of political clout. They haven't managed to succeed very well in persuading either the Congress or the President to adopt protectionist strategies. And so I think that particular example of yours is a bit of, well, let's say it's more complicated than resistance to globalization. The second point you made was...
Sure. To eliminate the welfare state, it's just maybe have the state withdraw. Even the Fraser Institute says that one-third of our taxes should go.
Right.
You know,
well,
one-third of our income should go to the government.
Sure.
The level of the state
well, in terms of OECD countries, advanced industrialized countries, Canada's tax levels have always been quite low, contrary to what some people have represented. They're considerably below the European social democracies. Ours was running, as I recall it, about 40%, and they typically run at 40 to 47% of the GNP goes to government expenditures. Only by comparison with the United States and with Japan do our tax levels appear out of line. Japan, of course, is a special case because so much of what we deliver through our tax system has historically been delivered in Japan through private means, essentially through company-based benefit schemes. So I think that's a somewhat misleading comparison, but clearly the most cogent comparison is with the United States, which has had for many years now lower tax rates, and ours are converging with theirs. Clearly our tax rates are coming down. And, well... maybe I speak.
But they're still going to be high, whether comparatively.
Well, I think my point is high compared to what? High compared to the United States, of course. High compared to other countries we'd like to compare ourselves with, not at all.
High compared to what it used to be.
I'm sorry?
And what it used to be.
Well, that's fair enough. And I return to a point I made, and I think we might agree on this. Part of people's reluctance to pay taxes as high as those we're paying, or even those which we're likely to pay in the next few years, is a sense that not all of the things we've spent our taxes on have worked out as well as we hoped. And there is a disenchantment with the social democratic agenda. Lots of things the state has undertaken to do, it hasn't done very well. And when we worry about the quality of public education, and when we worry about the welfare system and apparently sort of permanent people permanently on welfare and so on, you have to say there's something seriously wrong with the system. Whether it can be fixed with less money or more money, we'll only know when we try to fix it. I think it's a bit previous to say that simply by withdrawing money, we will fix the problems. And I've gone on so long, I've forgotten your third question. Okay, move on to another question. You wanted a short answer? My answers are no, yes, and maybe.
Well, the more exactly,
You'd like a little longer than that? Okay. Is it possible to turn the clock back? No, of course it's not possible to turn the clock back, nor would I wish it to be turned back. Secondly, if it were turned back, would we have as rich and vibrant a life as we have now? Probably not, but who knows? And we will never know, because you can't turn it back. It's a very hypothetical question. But certainly, I will say that when the hands were indicating an earlier time, we did have, in fact, a richer life than the one we have now. At least many people did. Not everybody, but many people in our society, in most of the countries like ours, in fact, had a better life 20 and 30 years ago than they do today. The level of incomes for ordinary people has fallen. The circumstances of life have deteriorated. The level of insecurity has increased. So I don't think we can go back, but I certainly don't believe that we have moved forward in this period which has coincided with globalization. Let me put it this way. I don't think that the leading trading countries of the world, or the major economic powers of the world, are anxious to turn the clock back. When we say we, let me define that as we Canadians turning the clock back. That's what I meant to say. It's not in our hands. Whatever is the dominant mode of international trade, alas, for better or worse, we will have to abide by it. I don't think we have the power as a small peripheral country, many of whose economic instruments are in other people's hands. I don't think we can turn the clock back. Well, that's an extremely interesting question. How will globalization affect federal and provincial responsibilities? It's very difficult, for me at least, to disaggregate globalization from other things that are happening at the same time. So subject to that admission, let me offer a suggestion. One might think that as global trade becomes a more important determinant of the way we lead our lives, that the government charged with responsibility for international trade, the federal government, would play a larger and larger role, trying to obtain the best terms for Canada under the treaties which set down the rules of the game. But that's not been the experience. We see power gravitating to the provinces. Is it gravitating to the provinces because they are able more effectively to operate in the international sphere? I don't think that's the case. I mean, no disrespect to the distinguished premier of this province, but I don't think it's absolutely clear that he will be a major player in the international resolution of this particular trade dispute or environmental dispute, if you prefer to characterize it that way. So there's something odd going on here. What's going on, it seems to me, is the coincidence of a lot of other things happening in Canadian politics and in the politics of some other countries with globalization. What does that coincidence, what's it all about? It's about this, in my view. We're experiencing an enormous amount of dislocation. People's dreams of the future are being disappointed. Constructive interventions have turned out not to be constructive. The way people have prepared themselves to participate in the workforce, now those ways have become obsolete. And people are very, very upset. People are scared. And when people are upset and scared, I think it's not surprising that they would wish power to gravitate to that government which they perceive to be closest to them and most subject to their, most responsive to their interests and wishes. So even though it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, I think the response that we're getting is devolve power, let us work things out because you, the federal government, have been so derelict in protecting our interests. And I think that's what's going on. That's my particular take on it. The question relates to what's happening to cash crops, agricultural crops, essentially, in the developing countries as a result of globalization, if I've correctly understood you. Tobacco is an example, but of course one complicated by the health factor. But let's be a little more generic. We'll talk about agricultural products generally. I think what's happening is the following. Partly because of the dissemination of new technologies, of new agricultural techniques, these countries are being weaned away from traditional methods of cultivation. To adopt modern methods requires capital. Capital for new technologies and capital for fertilizers and all of the other things, and a new infrastructure. To bring these cash crops to market. And of course, market now being a global market, not simply a local market. So that's money. You've got to borrow money. In order to borrow money, you become part of the world economy. And you're more and more closely integrated into it, which in terms of economic theory is very sensible. On the other hand, what that's doing is on the one side, disturbing the social organization built on traditional forms of cultivation, village life, family life, and so on. Those things are being radically disturbed. And on the other side, all this money floating around is creating serious perturbations in the political life of these countries. So to return to the question, could we turn the clock back? I doubt it very much. But I think globalization has helped to create a high degree of social instability and at least in the short to middle term a great deal of economic harm to these countries, even though in the long term it's quite possible that people may be better off. I certainly don't know that, and nobody can know that. And your point is well taken. I mean, there have been lots of trends which turned out not to be as everyone thought they would be. So let me accept that immediately as a fair comment. However, what we have been experiencing these last 20 years or so is in at least three ways I can think of immediately different from previous experiences of globalization. The first is technology, which has made possible globalizations of a dimension, an intensity, a pervasiveness, which didn't have any counterparts in the earlier period. The second is that at least that globalization represented by the British Empire did have structures. Somebody was in charge. The colonial office, essentially, was in charge within some limits. Nobody's in charge today, and I think that's a difference. And the third reason that I think we're experiencing something different is that we now have globalization which is emanating not just from one source, but from many sources, which, of course, is one reason why nobody's in charge. It's not just driven by America. It's driven by Japan and by Europe and so forth. And that makes a return to a more protectionist or regulated economy much more complex. So because as long as any major player wants to persevere, there'll be a lot of people that are prepared to take advantage of that situation. It's very difficult to shut down the flow of capital if a major stock market refuses to regulate capital. And that's a problem we didn't have to contend with in the heyday of the British Empire. So I don't want to be, sort of totally insensitive to the historical point you made that these trends may not eventuate, but I do think that's these three differences at least are different from an altered situation from what we had before.
China's withdrawal from this. take the history of that portion of the world for self-segregation, it's feasible, I think, to imagine that once they've gathered enough of the tools, they'll simply close the door and set up shop on their own.
What's the question?
I'm sorry, remind me of your first question. Your second.
How feasible do you think that is, and what do you think the consequences would be?
How feasible do I think China's withdrawal from the global economic regime is, and what would be the consequences? One has to start by saying that any country with whatever the population is now, obviously, is potentially in a better position to withdraw than our little country is. I mean, yes, in principle, they could revert to their historic isolationism. I personally think that rather unlikely. I think that for better or worse, and contrary to our friend at the top, I don't believe that the acceptance by the consumers of the world is a highly desirable, people identifying themselves as consumers in a global society is in any sense desirable. But it does, in fact, seem to have a lot of attractions for people. And if you've ever been in China or read a lot about China, you'll see that an awful lot of Chinese people are desperate to have their VCRs and all of the creature comforts which they associate with participation in the world economy. So to the extent that distribution of these goods is the way the Chinese government is pacifying their people at the same time as depriving them of political rights, I don't think it's likely that the Chinese government's going to cut itself off from what essentially keeps it in power, and alas, that part of it which is corrupt, which is a big part of it, keeps it rich. So I don't see at the moment in the foreseeable future that China will pull away from this global economy, at least until it feels it can domestically produce all of the things it needs to pacify people, which is not going to be in the very near future.
I'm afraid we have to go for the last short question.
Can you suggest a date by which you expect to see light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, can I anticipate a date at which we will see light at the end of the tunnel? No, I can't. I can't in two senses. One, obviously, I'm not clairvoyant, and I'm not even a sufficient expert to say trends are running in a particular direction, but for another reason as well. I think the light will appear very incrementally. We will not suddenly be bathed in this glow of a new, more democratic and responsive order. Well, I mean, I'll pick 100 rather than 1,000. But only to revert to someone else's, question, because we have had this same experience 200 years ago. If you go back to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, you see almost simultaneously the beginning of social democracy. And so these terrible oppressions that we experience seem to be generating their own antidotes at a somewhat slower pace than the problem itself. And so it seems to me maybe 100 years is not an unreasonable figure. Thank you.
Before I ask Mr. Stuart Klein to thank Harry Arthurs, I'd just like to remind everyone that next week, on November 22nd, Mr. Bruce Pullen, the director of the Vancouver Bach Choir, will be speaking here on The Human Voice. Now I will ask Mr. Stuart Klein to thank our speaker for the evening.
I think on behalf of all of us that we should extend an invitation to Professor Arthurs to join us in 100 years from now and give us the answer about the light at the end of the tunnel.